As you would imagine, a church this size, we were pretty organized and we planned way ahead. And so today's message was already scheduled before the events that unfolded this weekend in Ukraine. And yet what we're going to talk about today so intersects with all of that. And I just want to begin with this. One of history's greatest mysteries, perhaps history's greatest mystery is this. How did a first century cult, because that's what the church was considered when the church was first birthed, how did a first century cult birthed in the armpit of the Roman Empire? Judea was considered the armpit of the Roman Empire in the first century. If you were assigned to Judea, you had offended someone high up. You had done something terribly wrong. So how did a first century cult birthed in the armpit of the Roman Empire, whose leader, Jesus, was rejected by his own people and crucified, survive and thrive in the face of violent, organized, state-funded resistance? How did this happen? How did this cult movement, begun by a Galilean nobody, a day laborer, how in the world did it survive the context of its birth? Or let me ask it a different way. How did it come about that a Nazarene sect, because in the early years after Jesus, this is what the church was referred to, a Nazarene sect, because Jesus was from Nazareth, he was considered the dead leader, and yet this movement continued. How did it come about that a Nazarene sect would eventually be embraced by the very empire, the Roman Empire, that for 300 years sought to extinguish it? I mean, how in the world did this even happen? Or to maybe ask it in a more relevant way for some of you, if you've been to Rome recently, if you've ever visited the Roman Colosseum, you may have not noticed, but when you walk in the Roman Colosseum, there's an enormous cross hanging over the emperor's entrance to the Roman Colosseum. How is it that a building created to celebrate bloodshed and violence has a cross that represents Jesus hanging over the entrance? How did any of this even happen? Why are we even here? How did the Jesus movement survive the first century? Now, the interesting thing is this: historians have pondered this for generations, and they've all arrived at pretty much the same conclusion. I'm going to quote from a book I read years ago, Fields of Blood by Karen Armstrong. I was a big Karen Armstrong fan, still am, but I just read a bunch of her books, and I just ran across this quote, and I pulled it out and used it several times. Here's what Karen Armstrong says. She says, "Against all odds," and that is an understatement, "against all odds, by the third century, Christianity had become a force to be reckoned with." 300 years after the birth, and death, and resurrection of Jesus. And then this statement, we still do not really understand how this came about. Now, nobody can deny it happened, because here we are, right? Churches all over the country, churches all over the world, Jesus followers all over the world. Nobody denies it happened, but the mystery is, how did this happen? I mean, there is no actual explanation for it unless we take the word of the men and the women, the eyewitness testimony of the men and women who were actually there, who saw what happened and documented for future generations how, in fact, this came about. And it's amazing that it happened at all. But maybe more amazing, or certainly equally as amazing, is that Jesus of Nazareth actually predicted this. You're maybe familiar with this story. If you've been coming to one of our churches for a while, I refer to it 2 or 3 times a year. Jesus and his guys, his disciples, are way, way, way north of Jerusalem, up in basically what we would consider Syria. And they're outside this, they're in this region called Caesarea Philippi. And Jesus is asking them a question you should never ask your friends. He said, "What are people saying about me?" You should never ask your friends that question, right? But he says to them, "Hey, what's the word on the street about me?" And they say, "Well, some people think you're a reincarnated prophet from the old covenant. Some people think you're John the Baptist come back to life." And then he turns to him and then he says, "Well, you guys, what do you guys think about me? I mean, we've been together for a while." And Peter finally gets the right answer. And Peter says, "Well, just speaking for us, we believe that you're actually God's final king. We think you're God's anointed one. We think you're what we've been looking forward to as a race for a long, long time. We think you're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus smiles and says, "Peter, you're exactly right." And he says, "Boys, on this declaration, on this statement, on this observation, on this truth, on this rock, I will build my ecclesia. I will start a movement. I will build my congregation, my assembly, my gathering. And as you heard me say before, the English word church should have never appeared in our English Bibles because it's not a translation of this word. It's a German word that got slipped in at a different time when it was super political in terms of the terms being used to translate the Bible. But the term ecclesia refers to an assembly of people, not a building or a place or geography. It's a people. It's a movement. It's a gathering. It's dynamic. And Jesus says, I'm going to start a brand new movement. And the thing that will hold this movement together is, Peter, what you just said, that I am the Christ, the Son of the living God. And that's going to be the foundation for everything that happens. And then he makes this statement. Not only am I going to start a movement, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. Now, when we see Hades, we think hell, but they're not talking, he wasn't talking about hell. Hades was just a place of the dead. This was just a way of saying, and death won't stop it. Peter, when you die, it's not going to stop. John, when you die, it's not going to stop. And Matthew, when you die, it's not going to stop. But you got some writing to do before that time. And guys, my death, when I die, it will not be the end of this movement. This movement that we're beginning is going to outlive all of us. And here's what they thought. First, they looked around and said, you're starting a new movement with us? Wow. And the second thing they thought is this, Jesus, do you know what happens to people who begin new movements in this culture? Jesus, have you forgotten? Rome does not look favorably upon new movements. They're not fans of new movements. And neither are the temple leaders. They're not fans of new movements either. Jesus, do you know what happens to people who begin new movements? And he did. And it happened to him. And that's the mystery. And those same boys gathered in that epic moment when Jesus makes this extraordinary declaration would be the ones that would document why his death was not the death of his movement. Because Jesus didn't do what dead people normally do. Jesus didn't stay dead. That's why I love this. It's my favorite Bible prophecy. I will build my ecclesia. I will build my ecclesia. I will build a movement. I will build a gathering, an assembly, and a congregation of people, and nothing is going to stop it. It's my favorite Bible prophecy or prediction because Jesus predicted you and Jesus predicted us. That he inaugurated in those moments in that teaching, this upside down as we talk about kingdom of God that had come to earth. Wherever the king goes, the kingdom goes with him. And Jesus came as the king. That's why Peter said, you're the king. You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus launches or unveils this brand new way of thinking, this brand new way of living. It was a kingdom of conscience. It was a kingdom of the heart. It was a kingdom that would begin on the inside of people. And then it would be lived out in such a way that it would become contagious, appealing, offensive, but ultimately contagious. It became in some ways almost irresistible because it stood in such sharp contrast with the culture in which he unlaunched and unleashed these virtues and these values, his kingdom values. He flipped the self-evident, self-centered scripts of the ancient world. And he laid the foundation, as we talk about all the time, he laid the foundation for our modern sense of justice, our modern sense of fairness, our modern sense of dignity of the individual, our modern sense of equality, that red and brown and black and white and men and women and children, they would all be precious in God's sight, that everybody would have equal value. This was unknown in the ancient world. There was no foundation for it. What was self-evident in the ancient world is that some people were born to rule and some people were born to be ruled over. That was the way the gods had it. That was pagan religion. That was the assumption. And Jesus shows up with a completely different system of ethics, a different value system. And eventually, it caught on. And then in the end, this upside-down kingdom established by this upside-down king, in the end, this king would do the most extraordinary thing. He would lay down his life for his subjects instead of requiring his subjects to lay down their lives for him. And then, in the most unprecedented move of all, he would say before his arrest, he would say, and you, my followers, are to follow me in this. You are to lay down your lives, not for me. You're to lay down your lives for one another. You are to love each other in such a way that it's notable, noteworthy, noticeable You are to serve one another in such a way that the outside world looks at you and says, what is going on with those people? And not only that, you are to lay down your lives for those people as well. In fact, he said, I want you to take it this far. When someone views you as their enemy, you don't return the favor. I want you to love your enemy. I want you to serve those who persecute you. Unheard of. It's still unheard of today. But this was the upside down kingdom that Jesus launched and left in the world through his ecclesia, through his church. And this one another brand of love, this unconditional love your enemy brand of love, was to be their distinctive. He said at the very end, we talk about it all the time, as I have loved you, you're to love one another. The golden rule is out. This is the platinum rule. You don't do unto others as you would have them do unto you. We're taking it to a whole new level. I want you to love the people around you the way I have loved you. And then the next day, he would put on a demonstration of love that would take his breath away, their breath away, and it would take your sin away. He says, I want you to follow me. And as the citizens, you can read it. This is the mystery. This is the part nobody can explain. As the citizens of the empire, the Gentile empire, began to watch these strange little communities, these little ecclesias of Christians, and the way they treated one another, and the way they valued their women, and the way they treated their slaves, and the way they treated the people around them, and the way they did business, and the fact that they would take an oath together. We've talked about this. They would take an oath together once a week not to commit fraud, not to commit adultery, not to steal, and to do for others. This began to catch on in the empire. And the kingdom values of Jesus began to change the empire. And in the end, to quote Bart Ehrman, and this is one of the, I love Bart Ehrman. He's an atheist. He's a New Testament scholar, but atheist. I've read so many of his books, and I got to the end of this book, The Triumph of Christianity, and here's how Bart Ehrman, who's not a believer, ends his book. Here's what he writes. He said, Christianity not only took over an empire, it radically altered the lives of those living in it. Here's why this is important. Because in the first century, Christianity was not a belief system. You did not become a Christian because you believed something. You were a Christian if you acted and lived and behaved a certain way. He goes on to say this, it was a revolution that affected government practices, legislation, art, literature, music, philosophy, and then this. And on an even more fundamental level, this radical thing unleashed by Jesus, it changed the very understanding billions of people had about what it means to be human. Now, this is so important. You see, what we take for granted, what is self-evident to us, was not self-evident before Jesus. And what Bart is referring to is this, that Jesus tied the dignity of every woman and every man and every child and every ethnicity and people from all over the world. He tied their dignity not to where they were from, what they could accomplish or what they owned. He tied it back to this epic moment in the Garden of Eden when God made it clear that mankind, that womankind, the human race, were made in his image. That in every certain person you ever meet, anybody you're ever eyeball to eyeball with, there is a divine spark. They carry the image of God. And when that began to catch on, and when that became front and center, and when this became part of people's worldview, they realized everybody has dignity. Everybody has dignity. This is self-evident to us, but it was unusual and it was new. We assume it. It's what changed the world. Bart goes on and finishes with this. He says, however one evaluates the merits of the case, his point being, whether you like Christians or not, whether you like church or not, whether you used to be one and fell away, whether you have, you know, you're the last thing you want to do is consider yourself or even consider Christianity. He says, regardless of what you think about any of this, no one can deny. Here it is again. It was the Christian movement was the most monumental cultural transformation our world has ever seen. 300 years before anyone held a Bible in their hands. Now, friends, here's why I'm saying this. If you're at home, pay attention. Put down whatever else you were doing there for a second. I just want to make sure you hear this next part. Look up here. We are the stewards of that movement. We are a part of that. We are the church in our generation. We steward the faith of this generation and the next. And here's our options. We will either take from it what we can get and just consume, make sure my kids are baptized, my grandkids are baptized, make sure everybody prayed a prayer, everybody's going to heaven, you know, gonna, you know, listen to a little bit of that, listen to a little of this, you know, kind of take, make sure I'm there on Christmas and Easter. We can just consume and leave the church weaker, sidelined, and ineffectual in our culture. Or we can engage with it. We can engage with it to ensure that the church continues to be and continues to echo and continues to serve as the conscience of our nation and ultimately the conscience of our world. Case in point, this weekend we have experienced something extraordinary on multiple levels, but here's a level you haven't thought of. Why is it that most of the world thinks what's happening in Ukraine is wrong? Why is it that especially most of the first world countries, most of the world thinks that what's happening there is an atrocity? Why does the world just assume that's bad, that's wrong, you should not impose your will on another nation, you should not impose your laws and your values on another nation, you have no right to cross a border? Why is it we assume that's wrong? Why does that bother us? Once upon a time, that was just common sense. Once upon a time, that was just the way things were. Once upon a time, no one would second guess anyone's right to conquer another people. That's just the way it was. Why is it that all over the world where the church has taken root and where the church has left a shadow and a shade of what the church is all about, why is it that the world is just aghast and offended by what's happening? I'm telling you, it's not because of human nature. It is the leftover. It is the shadow. It is the remnant of the teaching of Jesus as exported through the church for a couple of thousands of years. And men and women who have nothing to do with church, have nothing to do with God, they intuitively know that's wrong, but they don't know why. So why is it wrong for one nation to conquer another? Why is it wrong? Why is it immoral? Why? What is it in us? I'm telling you, it's not human nature. Do you know what human nature is? Have you ever raised a child? Yeah, did you ever have to tell your child, be selfish, do not quit sharing? No, human nature is I'm gonna take everything I can for me, and if it comes my way, it's for me, and if I can take some of yours and get by with it, I'm gonna take it. And if somebody else takes what's yours and they get by with it, then I'm gonna follow suit. If somebody is taking what's yours and it doesn't belong to me, while you have your back turned, I'm gonna come across the other border and take what I can. I mean, that's just the way it is. That's the way the world works. And I'm telling you, that was self-evident until the teaching of Jesus as exported through the church. We are experiencing in our world the value of the teaching of Jesus that has conformed and informed the conscience of the world to some extent, except in those nations and except in those regions where the church has never really been free to thrive. What we're talking about today and who we are, it's a really, really big deal. And you are part of it. Now, you read the same stuff I do. You're smart people. You're educated people. You're dialed into what's going on in culture. The experts are telling us the church in America is dying and the pandemic just sped up the inevitable. So I'm gonna ask you a question. I don't want you to answer it out loud, okay? No amens, no, don't clap. I'm just gonna ask you a question. I just want you to think about this one. Do you know who determines whether or not this is true? I'll ask it a different way. Do you know who determines whether or not your children have the opportunity to be raised in a dynamic church? Do you know who determines whether or not your grandchildren have an opportunity to sit in environments and have their minds renewed through the reality of God and the teaching of Jesus? Do you know who determines whether or not we become like Europe? I have friends in Europe who are pastors. We work with church planters in Europe all the time. And they're struggling to bring relevance, and they're struggling to bring energy back to the church in Europe where all of this began once upon a time. And do you know what they would say to those of you who are Americans or those of you who live in the United States who are Christians? Here's what they would say to you. They would say to you, fight for it. Don't give it up. support it, show up for it, keep it on the forefront of American culture. Don't become like us. You have no idea what you have. Don't give it up. Don't take it for granted. It may not always be here. Just because it's always been here, just because you were raised with it, just because you drive by one every 300 yards when you're driving through a city, don't take that for granted. Because the strength of the church is the strength of a nation, and the strength of a church is the conscience of the nation. And that, my friends, can go away because once upon a time, it did not exist. Do you know who decides whether those things are true or not? We do. We do. Because you are the church. You are our church. You are your church. The question is, will we be the ecclesia of Jesus? Will we be and extend the movement of Jesus? Will we fulfill our divine mandate? And I, for one, as you can tell, I say yes. But it's not gonna happen without us. And here's the part I wasn't sure I wanted to say, but I decided to leave it anyway, because I don't know what you should do for a living. I don't know where you should send your kids to school. I can't tell you how to live your life. It's kind of none of my business, but there are some things that suddenly become my business as long as I'm your pastor, and this is one of them, okay? Engaging in the body of Christ and engaging in God's work in the world through the local church is God's will for you. I don't know who you should marry, but I know you need to do this. I don't know where you should send your kids to school, but I know you need to do this. I don't know how you invest, and I don't know when you retire, but I'm telling you, this is God's will for you. And you are here, and you are grateful for the local church because a previous generation was a good steward of their opportunity to steward the dynamic and the influence of the church. You are, as the Apostle Paul would say, you are the body of Christ. In fact, you're familiar with this language. Paul, first century, writes a letter. He's the ultimate Christian, the ultimate church planner. And he planted these churches, these little ecclesias, house churches in Corinth. And they were really messed up. I mean, if you read 1st, 2nd Corinthians, there's actually a 3rd Corinthians. 1st, 2nd, 3rd Corinthians. We don't know what happened to 3rd Corinthians. I think when the Corinthians got it, they're like, we're not doing that. They just tore it up. So it didn't survive. I just made that part up. We don't know what happened to it. But these people were messed up. I mean, there was all kind of crazy stuff going. And the Apostle Paul writes them this letter. And here's what he says. He says, hey, you as a group, you collectively, plural, you are the body of Christ in Corinth. The people of Corinth aren't going to know what Jesus is like except for looking at you, and you're not acting like Jesus. So together, collectively, start being the hands and the feet of Jesus in Corinth. To which some of the people, a part of that church, were like, well, you know, I don't like him, I don't like her. And Paul's like, shut up. Each one of you is part of it. Yeah, but I don't like him. And Paul's like, whoa, you don't understand what I'm saying. So he illustrates it in this crazy, funny, I think that they laughed when they read this. He says, okay, let me illustrate it this way. Now, if your feet started talking, yeah, they laughed when they read this. If your foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I want to be a hand. I've always wanted to be a hand. I don't get to be a hand. I don't belong to the body anymore. It would not for that reason stop being part of the body, would it? Just because your hand's tired of being a hand or your foot's tired of being a foot. Paul's going, so what? It's irrelevant. You are part of the body. As if they didn't get that one, he gives them another one. If the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I'm not going to play. I'm not going to participate anymore because I wanted to be an eye and I didn't get to be an eye, so I'm not coming back. I'm not doing it. He's like, so what? I did not belong. It would not for that reason stop being part of the body. I mean, if one of your body parts decides I don't want to be part of the body, it's like too bad. So sad. You're part of the body. Now you are, he says. You are the body of Christ collectively, and each one of you is part of it. So look up here. If you're Christian, like it or not, like me or not, like us or not, you're part of the body. The question is, are you gonna act like it? Am I gonna act like it? And are we gonna be the body of Christ, even though we don't like all the parts of the body? Or are we gonna take our consumer mentality, and we all have it, I have it, we all have it, and decide, well, until I can, it can be just the way I want it. And Paul says, no. If you wanna represent Jesus, if you wanna be the conscience of your nation, of your community, you wanna change the world again, you wanna reverse things going on in culture, Would you like there to be the nations that currently don't worship Jesus, where the ecclesia of Jesus takes hold and shapes that culture and the values of men and women and children in that culture? You want to see that happen? Then you got to start acting like a body. I had an illustration I was going to give, but Sandra and I talked about it, and she helped me agree that it was so gross that I would lose some of you. Some of you pass out, some of you just leave. So I'm going to skip it. But basically here, the illustration would, you know, have you ever seen a disconnected body part? It is gross. So here's what Paul's saying to us. Don't be gross. Connect. Engage. Be engaged. And for some of you, and I understand this, re-engage. So here's the thing. If you're grateful for our local church or the local church you attend, part of our network or wherever you're watching from, and I know you're grateful, you wouldn't be part of that church, but you're not engaged, you're just a consumer, hey, it's time to engage. I can say this with certainty, and I don't say this about many things. This is God's will for you. You are not in God's will if you're not engaged with the local church, if you're a Christian. And for those of you who are watching online, I get that. Sandra and I say all the time, and please don't let this get out of the room. You know, when we're not attending live, which is very rare, and we're watching online, we look at each other and we say, no wonder people stay at home. This is so good. I mean, we have done such a great job creating an online at-home experience, which we want to, because we want to export what we're doing all over the world, especially for people who don't have an opportunity to find a local church. But if you're watching online and your kids are grown, you know, and you don't feel connected, I understand that. I get it. But you're in a season of life. You're in a season of life where you're going to have to be more intentional. And you're in a season of life where you have more margin and you have more resources. And I would say, oh, we need you. But it's not that we need you. You need us because you are part of this body. And we will never, never take advantage of. We will never maximize our potential of influence until the whole body is engaged. And I'm not going to beg you. In fact, I don't think I'm even going to bring it up again. But I'm inviting you. But here's the thing. I want to be clear. I'm not inviting you to attend something. If this was just about attending something, then watch from home. It, you know, it's cheaper for us. It lowers our expenses. And we don't have to have as many volunteers if it's just attending something. I'm inviting you to participate in something. Because the first century Christians who participated in their little, tiny, disenfranchised, socially ostracized ecclesias, they changed culture and shaped Western culture. And there's so many of us, and we are so resourced, and we have so much talent and ability. Imagine if we just got, if we engaged the way we should. So if you're not going to engage here, engage somewhere, but engage. Because you're a member of the body of Christ. So participate like one. And besides, this is the invitation of a lifetime. The church is the hope of the world. The church is the hope of the world because Jesus said the people of the church are the light of the world. And if you think that sounds strange to us, when Jesus first said that to the group of people he was talking about, you know, he gives a speech and a sermon, you are the light of the world. And they're like, no, we're not. We're poor. We're overtaxed. None of us have been more than 10 miles away from home. We're not the light of anything. Jesus is going, oh, yes, you are. You are the light of the world. If you are following me, if you're going to invest in what I'm teaching, if you're going to do what I'm saying, you're going to be like the wise man who builds his house on the rock. If you're going to do it, practice what I'm preaching, I'm telling you, you become the light of the world. And this light is going to spread and spread and spread and multiply, not because of what you believe, but because of how you behave and how you live your life and how you love one another and how you decide, just because somebody considers me an enemy, I am not going to return the favor. And when the church flourishes, people flourish. And when churches flourish, the people in those communities, they flourish. Now, we have a very simple mission here. Hopefully you've heard it a million times by now. It's simply to inspire people to follow Jesus. Not just believe, not just become a Christian, not just get baptized, follow. But here's the part we don't talk about much in church because it's a little long and clunky, but this is kind of fills in some of the details. Here's how we do it. We inspire people collectively to follow Jesus by engaging them in the life and mission of our local church. We want children to be engaged in the life of this church because they'll be inspired to follow Jesus. We want teenagers to be engaged in the life of this church because we want them to know how to follow Jesus. We want college students and singles and newlyweds and senior adults and young marrieds and people who are navigating kids in high school. We want people to engage in the life of our church because you've proven this. You know how to create, and you know how to finance and support extraordinary environments for people. Following Jesus and being engaged in a local church really will make your life better and make you better at life. So our goal is to engage, but to be faithful to what God has called us to do and to take advantage of the unique opportunities we have as a large network church. Then we need all of the body parts to get engaged. So I want to give you three ways specifically. Number one, I want you to look out for, come sit with me opportunities. If you're familiar with our three knots, some of you know about our three knots, some of you don't, we may need to talk about it more. And here's what I mean by that. Whenever you hear one of the three knots, you just automatically say, come sit with me. Come sit with me. Sandra's here today. This has become a little bit of a game. She'll get home and say, well, I had a come sit with me opportunity today. I'll say, hey, today I was so-and-so. I had a come sit with me opportunity today. Three knots. This is what you're listening for. Knot number one, not in church. Not really a church person. Well, come sit with me. Well, I said I'm not a church person. I know, yeah, but our church is different. Come sit with me. It doesn't matter who's preaching. It doesn't matter what the sermon series is. You just automatically say, come sit with me. Not in church. Knot number two, things are not going well. Things are not going well. Marriage, things are not going well. Finances, things are not going well. The career, things are not going well. With my middle schooler, things are not going well. Oh, wow, I'm not a counselor. Come sit with me. What do you mean come sit with you? You need to come to my church. Why? Because here's what, come on, here, look. Because whatever someone in this world or this culture, it's not going well for them. There are people here that it was not going well for them either. We can help. You can help. You just say, come sit with me in my church. Yeah, I don't know what we're talking about. I don't know who's preaching. Just come sit with me. And the third knot, not prepared for. Just got married. Not prepared, were you? Just had our first child. Thought we were prepared. Not prepared. Just had twins. Really? Not prepared. Just moved to the city. Don't have any friends. Not prepared for the isolation and the loneliness. Just started a new job. My kids, my last child just graduated from high school and went to college, and I just wasn't prepared. Oh, listen, come sit with me. Come sit with me. Come sit with me. And let me tell you what's going to happen. Most folks won't. So you get credit, and you don't have to save them a seat. It's perfect, right? But imagine, come on, work with me, imagine. Imagine this many thousands of people everywhere. Well, come sit with me. Come sit with me. Come sit with me. Do you know how many invitations it takes for somebody to finally show up at a church they've never been to? Unless it's somebody they're locked in with as super close friends. About 5 invitations. You know why we know this? Because we've experienced this so many times. Sandra come home and say, I was listening to this lady, talking to the lady at the counter, and I got up there and said, I couldn't help but overhear. Hey, you know, have you heard of our church? You know, come sit with me. And how many times have we heard, you know what, I've heard of that church. You know, somebody else invited me to that church. So it's not the first time or the second time or the third time, but come sit with me. And here's the thing, and I got to move on. Some of you know how important this is, but many of you don't. You have no idea what hangs in the balance of an invitation. Do you know how I know that? Because just about anybody who's baptized here and anybody we hear tell their story, somebody invited them. Somebody invited them. They're like, I'm not sure. I don't know. And somebody took a risk and said, come sit with me. And now they're like, oh my goodness. I can't imagine where my marriage would be. I cannot imagine where my kids would be. I can't imagine where I would be if you hadn't extended that invitation. So here's how I want you to engage. You just come sit with me. But the problem is nobody can come sit with you if you aren't coming to sit, right? And this is what's happened for a lot of people in my season of life. I get it because you're comfortable. You're giving, so grateful. You're in a group, so grateful. But you can't invite anybody to come sit with you. And you know what? You have, again, more margin and time to create that opportunity to come sit with me. Uber drivers who have come sit with us. I mean, all kind of people would just surprise, like, okay, we will. Like, oh, they're coming. And hey. And you know what happens when somebody comes and sits with you, whether you know them or not? Let me just tell you what happens. You become emotional. This is so important. You become emotionally engaged with your local church, and here's why. Because when you know your brother-in-law is finally coming, your sister-in-law is finally coming, your high school senior said, I'm going to give it one more shot, that stranger that you met that's like, she's decided, hey, I'm going to show up. Do you know what happens? When you show up at church, it's a completely different experience for you. Because you're like, Andy, don't say anything stupid. I hope the music's excellent, but short. I hope the parking lot is organized. I hope people, suddenly you are gonna feel what some of us feel every single weekend, and suddenly you're gonna love your church and you are gonna be engaged at an emotional level you have never been engaged with, or it's been a long, long time. That's what I want you to sense and feel, because every single Sunday, including this Sunday, Somebody has taken a chance and they got him in here. In fact, they're sitting through this message going, I don't know if this is going well because you're actually talking about what I did and they're sitting here. You can just chill out because you know what the person you invited is experiencing? That we don't want something from people. We want something for people because following Jesus, regardless of what you believe about Jesus, following Jesus will make your life better. It'll make you a better husband and wife and father and child and employee and employer. And I want you to feel that tension. And I want you to help us prepare for the other people who are saying, come sit with me. Second way you can participate. You got to get in a small group or stay in your small group or engage in your small group. This is how big church feels small. This is how people know you when you need something, accountability, belonging, and care. Some of you, I hear these stories, we get them. It's like, well, I was in a group and then this guy moved and the leader, and so the group just kind of fell apart and so I'm out. I'm like, no, that's not how the world works. You don't do that in any other arena. I mean, you get your hair cut, right? You don't have a good doctor. You don't give up on doctors, get a bad haircut. You don't give up on haircuts. You just find a better one, right? New one. If you have a 20-year-old son or daughter who went off to college and they got involved in a church and you're like, thank God they're in church. And then they're like, this thing happened at the church. I'm giving up on church. You don't want them to give up on church. You say, honey, just go find another church, right? So for some of you, you got to reengage. You have used a little hiccup in a group experience to bail out of community. You got to get back in. And for some of you, you say, well, you know, we did that group thing for a while and it just sort of become the same old, same old. I'm not getting anything out of it. Well, you know what that means? It means it's time for you to lead, not leave. It's time to step up, to lead a starting point group. It's time to step up and lead a young adult group here. We have this cool environment now for young adults in their 20s looking for group leaders, a living room group. We have three college ministries at three of our campuses. There's all kinds of opportunities for you to step up. Well, I'm not sure I have time. That's a little bit like, well, I wanted to be a hand, but I'm an ear. So I'm just saying, don't write it off because it's inconvenient. And then the third one is I need you to volunteer. In just a minute, I'm gonna talk a little bit more about that. Now, I've gotta wrap this up. Well, let me say this about volunteering. Whenever we bring this up, people are like, I'm busy. Look, we built this church with busy people. I mean, busy people get things done. That's why they're busy. So busy is an excuse. I mean, this is why it's so good here. It's because we engage busy people. So anyway, I know you're busy. I'm glad you're busy. We want to help with that. And I'll talk about more in a minute. Now, I've got to wrap it up this way. And this may be a little strange, but this is the home team, so bear with me. I have a really good life. I mean, I have a great marriage. I have three incredible kids. They all live, 40, 45 minutes, one direction or the other. So grateful. I have a truck. I have a Ford pickup truck. And I have a convertible. It's several years old, but I got a convertible. So I'm good. I'm happy. I have nothing to prove. I've been part of this big thing. I wrote books, But my heart is so broken over what has happened in the church in America. I'm so broken over the disunity. We have allowed politicians to make us a constituency and a voting block. We're supposed to be the unified conscience of the nation. Here's the thing. I'm not trying to get you to clap. I just want to make a point. Look, disagreement, hey, that's going to happen. Disunity is a choice, and we have chosen to be disunified, and we've lost our voice. I want us to change that. My heart is broken over this as well. My heart is broken over the 20-something-year-olds and 30-year-olds that have, they got a new phrase, but it's not a new idea. They're deconstructing their faith. I've deconstructed my faith. And the reason they've deconstructed their faith is because they've been given and grown up on a faith that's easy to deconstruct. They've been raised on the Bible tells me so version of faith, which 15 years ago, I abandoned in terms of my language because I knew this was a problem and we were going to help fix it. Their faith needs to be, and this is where you're going to help. Their faith must be tethered to the event that launched the movement that 300 years later eventually brought us the Bible. Our faith is to be anchored to the event of Jesus' resurrection that launched the movement, the church, that eventually when it was safe and the Roman Empire had capitulated to the church, finally the bishops could come out of hiding and bring this sacred literature they'd risked and lost their lives over to be assembled. And the first Bible was finally assembled. For 300 years, they had no established literature and they changed the world. That's the version of faith I want to anchor this generation to and the next generation to. And it's our responsibility and it's our opportunity as a local church. So as you can tell, I am more passionate than ever, and it's because we have more potential than ever. So to those of you who've given consistently and served consistently, even through the pandemic, thank you. We would not be where we are without you. And I hope you've heard me say that to you before. To those of you who've grown a little bit content to just sort of, you know, consume content, it's time to step up and get engaged. It's time to find your place in the body. And if you have a hard time, that's okay. Don't give up. You've done hard things before and we want to help. So I just say, come on, let's do this. Because against, this is what the secular historians say. I didn't make this up. Against all odds. Against all odds we can't even imagine, the church changed the world once. And there's still a lot in this world that needs to change. And we hold the keys because God has given us a stewardship of influence and size and resources. So by God's grace and with your help, perhaps we can bring about some of the change that needs to be changed in our communities, in our city, in our nation, maybe in the world. Historically speaking, the Jesus movement should have been buried right alongside its founder, but it wasn't. John, who was an old man when he wrote these words, he says, the darkness did not overcome it. Of course it didn't. Jesus said that it wouldn't. So let's make sure the darkness doesn't overcome the church and our generation and our communities. It's on our watch. The church is worth it. You won't regret it. The faith of the next generation may depend on it.